From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Well, our connection this hour was made last week with the release of a report to Rochester City Council about the death of Daniel Prude 1 year ago. The report from the special investigator concluded that Mayor Lovely Warren deliberately suppressed information about Daniel Prude's death from reaching the public, then lied to the public about what she knew about the case and when she knew it. The 84-page report is also critical of former Rochester Police Chief Laron Singletary for his role in misleading the public and city officials about what happened and what caused Daniel Prude's death. The report describes a culture inside City Hall that favors the withholding of information, a lack of transparency by choice, led by City Attorney Tim Curtin, who routinely used shoddy legal grounds to deny just about any information getting out. And the report mentions City Councilmember Mary Lupien, who found out about Prude's death last July, but was asked by Daniel Prude's family not to go public with it. The report confirms her account, that while she was troubled, she was urged not to say anything, while the family considered their options going forward. This hour, we asked Councilmember Lupien to join us on Connections. She'll explain her decision, and we want to discuss the response to mental health crisis calls going forward. The City of Rochester has promised a new approach with so-called PIC teams, P-I-C, standing for People in Crisis. Those teams would be called to, for example, the recent case that ended up with police pepper spraying a 9-year-old girl in distress. But why wasn't the PIC team sent to that call? Is the city prepared to roll out this new approach? And what else should change when it comes to how certain calls are handled in the future? Our guests this hour include Mary Lupien, member of Rochester City Council. Mary, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Evan.
Chaku Mathai is with us. Chaku is a mental health and substance use ex-patient and a recovery advocate from Rochester, an appointed member of the New York State Behavioral Health Services Advisory Council, and vice president for the National Association for Rights Protection and Advocacy. Chaku, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Evan.
And Melanie Funches is with us, a mental health advocate and member of the Greater Rochester Black Agenda Group and the Black Healers Network. Melanie, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Evan, for the opportunity.
I'm going to start with Councilmember Lupien, and just so we sort of clear any misunderstanding about what you knew about the Daniel Prude case. This has been previously reported, but I think the official report to City Council does confirm what we seemed to already know. When did you first hear about this, Mary?
I first learned about a death in custody in July from the lawyer for the family. And just to make it clear in your introduction, neither the family nor the activists knew that the lawyer had shared that with me, and that's Elliot Shields. And, you know, I was working with him on another case of police brutality from a neighbor, and that's how we got in contact, and he just shared that with me. And so as the case unfolded, he continued to share, you know, when I first heard about it, he didn't know the extent because he hadn't yet seen the video. And I think the biggest thing to note here is that the release of the video is really what held up the public knowing. Because, you know, without really understanding the extent of what happened that night on March 23rd, it's hard to really explain it to the public. And the video was made available to the lawyer and the family only at some point, I think, at the beginning of August, and then released to the lawyer on the 13th, which was then, you know, put that plan in motion to release it to the public. And so I knew from the beginning that he was working with the family and local Black Lives Matter activists to release the footage when it became available. And, you know, though I knew that the city was stalling, the report still to me was eye-opening as to the extent of the cover-up. And the reason why I felt like, you know, even though the lawyer asked me to keep it quiet, I felt that, you know, the family really deserved the right to be able to release the footage and expose the cover-up. I knew that if I told my fellow council members, who I fully believed already knew, if they knew that I knew, that it would arise suspicion that it was getting out to the public and it would kind of spur a save face campaign to distort the facts of the case. And without the video to make to help people be aware of how horrible this incident was and how much, you know, the police are at fault here. I really felt like the truth would not have been served.
Mm-hmm. Did you think at any point, you know, if I were just a private citizen, I could certainly respect the attorney representing the family and I could respect those wishes of keeping it quiet for now. But did you think at any point your role on city council compelled you to say anything publicly?
You know, that's a... I felt like my role was to make sure that the truth was exposed. And it's a very tricky and political situation that I was in. And I made the choice that I felt was in the interest of the truth becoming known.
Yeah, I mean, in other words, let me just ask, in your own mind, was there any doubt that the public would find out at some point, you know, that your decision in July not to, to go public with what you knew was not, it seems to me, based on the idea that this would be stay quiet forever. Is that right?
Right. No, and I knew I had been getting updates on, you know, the judge mandating that the city release the video, that their denials of the FOIL were not correct. So I knew that it was in the process. You know, if it had ever come to the point where they're not going to release this video, then I would have pursued, you know, pushing it from the inside. But I knew that it was going to be coming out. It was just a matter of when.
The report concluded that the mayor and certainly Tim Curtin, every time he was involved with the decision, seemed to come up with some reason that the public should not get information, that the family shouldn't get information, that people shouldn't see the video. That, I mean, it is a culture of a lack of transparency described in this lengthy report that unfortunately journalists and I'm sure others in the community know about, but it is not a culture of transparency. And the report concluding that the mayor and other members of the administration knew by late March, certainly by early April, that the mayor was told of the report uses the term substantial physical restraint was used, and that the restraint and not a drug overdose caused Daniel Prude's death, and that the officers were the subject of a criminal investigation. So with all of these conclusions and the conclusion that even after things got out in September, the first week of September, that the mayor misrepresented to the public what she knew about it, do you, as a member of Rochester City Council, have any sort of desire or interest to join those, for example, in the activist community who have called for the mayor's resignation?
I'm not going to comment on that just because... And I think that, you know, we're dealing with this on the state level now. What happens in the vacuum of resignation may not serve us, you know, because the people that are ready to take power in that vacuum may not have our best interests at heart. And so I think, you know, I think that this next election, the people will speak.
And the election, of course, is 3 months away. So, I mean, I certainly take that point. And one last note on that. The mayor is being challenged in this election in the Democratic primary by one of your colleagues on city council, Malik Evans. And he released a statement after this report was released to city council. His statement read, in part, and as quoted by the Democrat and Chronicle, quote, "At a time when many in the community have lost faith in government, unfortunately, this report did little to restore confidence. The report makes clear that this tragedy was compounded by the fact information related to Daniel Prude's death was not handled in an open and transparent manner. My thoughts and prayers continue to be with the Prude family, and it is my hope that together we can work to rebuild trust and transparency in government," end quote. Now, he doesn't use anyone's name. He doesn't mention Mayor Warren. He doesn't mention anyone else. When he talks about the lack of transparency, he's your colleague. Have you spoke to him? I mean, were you concerned he was talking about you as well, or do you think he was talking about the mayor and the administration?
I'm not. I don't think that he was talking about me. I know that he was surprised you know, to learn as many were that I had prior knowledge, but I think he understands my reasoning.
Talking to Mary Lupien, a member of Rochester City Council, who has been central, I think it's fair to say, to the creation of alternatives to response calls for people in distress. Council member, can you take me through your role, for example, in the creation of PIC teams and your feeling on whether this is sufficient, whether the change going forward needs to be even more significant in how police and how the community responds to distress calls?
I can say that as much as I think that the PIC team, the People in Crisis team, is fulfilling a huge need, we're always, you know, we're going to need more. This is, the PIC team is a piece of the puzzle. But, you know, we're in this process of reimagining policing right now. We have a police reform plan that we're submitting at the end of the month. Council's voting on it on the 25th. There's so much more that we need to do. But, you know, I was involved in the creation of the PIC team with Commissioner Danielle Lightman-Torres and many other people in the community. And I believe both Melanie and Chaku also were participants in that. And we were all at the county level as well. And so this team, you know, was conceived, modeled after the White Bird Clinic in Cahoots in Eugene, Oregon, to respond instead of police when possible and with police when there's danger and violence present. And there was a lot of good work that went into creating this team, and I believe in the model. You know, it started in September, and the concept was set up in September, and by January it was started. And things in government do not move that fast. So I do appreciate, you know, the urgency that was put into creating this team. It started in the middle of January, and so without, you know, the full funding that it needed or the full staffing that it would really need to meet the number of calls in our community, they started out small. And there's 25 total calls related to mental health, call codes from 911, and they started off responding to 3, which had to do with mental health and suicide that were not violent. So a lot of the calls that we've that have come in, you know, with the that have been ended tragically, like the pepper spraying of the 9-year-old, the mother with her 3-year-old, Tyshawn Jones, those wouldn't have qualified for this response because either they didn't come in as a mental health call or they involved some level of violence. And I'm frustrated with the rest of the city that it seems like we have this team that's going to do good, but it's not quite there yet. But I can say that there is resources being put into it now, and they're hiring and building towards being able to respond to all mental health calls.
Just so I'm clear on what you're saying, take, for example, the case where police pepper sprayed the 9-year-old girl. You're saying even with a fully functional and fully funded and operational PIC team, that would not be a call? If that exact call happened in the future, that would not be a PIC team response call?
As it stands, because it came in as a, I believe it was a stolen vehicle or family trouble, that wouldn't be one of those 25 calls. But, you know, in this, there was a training bulletin issued on the 12th that kind of talks about the PIC crisis team involvement with police, and it lays it out and says PIC can assist with crisis counseling, transports, you know, those kinds of things. Depending on availability, PIC will be dispatched to all calls involving mental health issues. Members can request PIC and response to calls for individuals in crisis. So it certainly leaves the door open for outside of these mental health calls that they can be called for by the police. But to take it a step further, City Council is issuing a memo to the Crisis Intervention Services that would request that it respond to all calls involving children. And this would be a very big change and would require 911 and 211 to make the inquiry if there are children present when 911 calls come in.
All right.
In that way, it would have been able to respond to that specific incident.
Yeah, in a moment, I'm going to turn to your co-panelists because their insight as to how we do this going forward, I think, is key here. Last point on that particular case, Councilmember Lupien. I said on this program last week, and you know, I took some heat from some listeners who felt that I was too strong in my remarks about how police handled that call. But I urge anyone who hasn't to watch the full tape or watch the NPR video in which they called in experts in several different fields to respond to how police handled that. And there is not a single justification for the first officer on a scene when a 9-year-old girl is, you know, hysterically upset, for the officer to say, the first thing he says to her is, stop it, and then says, don't make me chase you. I've got a whole fleet of cars coming here to chase you. I cannot think of any justification for talking to another human being, let alone a child like that, unless your goal is to inflame. And I took some heat from listeners who said, well, you're not being fair, and the hallmark of the program is fairness and understanding the complexity of situations, and it is. But I don't understand it, Councilmember Lupien. And if what you're telling me is, part of what you're telling me is that City Council is trying to make sure that any calls involving children in the future will involve PIC team members. But there will be calls where PIC team members are not there. And I don't know what the training says that officers should talk to kids like that in any situation. Do you? I mean, my concern is that gets repeated.
I'm concerned about that as well. We're not going to be able to, unless we take drastic measures, prevent police from, eventually coming upon a situation like that again. And I think we really do need to dissect the culture of the RPD and the training and the supervision because it's inadequate. And it makes me feel like our officers are out there and out of control, not understanding their own trauma and how it impacts their and background and culture that they come from. You know, many of these officers have only heard kind of folklore about how terrible the city is and never came here before working here. So much needs to be addressed to make sure that this doesn't happen again.
Okay, let me turn to your co-panelist, Chaku Mathai. Let me start with you. When you look at either the case of the 9-year-old girl being pepper sprayed, the mother with a 3-year-old who was taken to the ground and then tased, and you think about going forward, what teams respond to what calls, are you confident, Chaku, that what is in place in Rochester will have the appropriate people responding to individual calls?
So thank you, Evan, for having me and Mary and Melanie. I'm not confident yet. I think there's a lot of information I still need to see personally. I think Mary has more information than I do about what the PIC teams have already responded to. But overall, what we're seeing is a lack of a trauma-informed community response. There's even just picking up on Mary's comment about being trauma-informed even around police trauma, that engagement and that cycle of response that really that you mentioned, Evan, in the first words of the police officer, isn't just about de-escalation. It's about recognizing the impact of those words, right? And so I think if we ask ourselves, what would a trauma-informed community response look like, whether it's what our police looks like, whether it's what our school bus drivers look like, whether it's our teachers, and there's a multiple pronged approach here that requires everyone to be on that page of, and I think what happens a lot of times for many of us, including myself, who are people with lived experience with psychosis, with being perceived as dangerous, with having been diagnosed with psychotic disorders, PTSD, these are substance use issues, when we're engaged, we're not often seen as people, and so when you intersect that with the experience, also, I'm also a person of color, these intersections compound. And I don't think that's been included in the crisis intervention training, for example, of police as well. That's something we have asked for. I think they're starting to consider that. But police training, and I was one of the first people in the original trainings for police, of trained police, negotiators, parole officers, probation. And, you know, it's wholly inadequate in terms of the training model itself. So it requires a transformation of our systems in that regard.
Melanie Funchess, how do you see it? Oh, might be on mute. Just want to make sure
I'm right here.
I'm here.
My phone was not muting like it should. I agree with Chaku that I am not thoroughly convinced. I also want to echo what he said about having a trauma-informed response, and that response also needs to be culturally responsive. What I think us as a community, what we really need to do, and this is not just about when we deem somebody to be in mental, having a mental health issue. We have to have a different conversation in our city on how do we keep us safe? What does safety look like for us as a community? And how do we judge humanity? The fact of the matter is, in the case of the 9-year-old girl, the man said to her, you're acting like a child. She retorted, I am a child. I cannot train now, you know, Chaku has gang loads more experience than me, but between us, we have spent umpteen years training different groups of people. The one thing I think, and I think Chaku would agree with me, the one thing I cannot train you in is how to see me as human. I can't train humanity. You have to bring it with you. And until we're able to have a conversation about people not being able to see the humanity of other human beings and how that is a prerequisite for any of these types of response, to be any kind of a responder. Because if they saw Daniel Prude as human, they would have realized it was a cold night and he needed to be covered. If the people saw Daniel Prude as human, they wouldn't have laughed while they loaded him in the ambulance. If they saw that mother outside of that store as human, they wouldn't have questioned why she was grabbing to her child for dear life in the face of what she perceived as danger. But when you do not see people as human, you can't see any of those other things.
Can I ask you then, Melanie, I want to focus on what we do about this. And when you say that, you know, in large part, you can't train people to see others as humans. I wish I had it in front of me. I saw, amazingly, a little piece of wisdom on Twitter last week where somebody wrote, often you'll hear people, white families in the suburbs, talking about bad neighborhoods in the city. But if you go there, what you find is just black people living. And just living. And and I thought that was pretty profound, given some of the conversations I've had with listeners who don't spend a lot of time in the city of Rochester, don't live there, have assumptions about it. And then when you look at who is employed in the Rochester Police Department, it is mostly people who don't live there. So when you hear Mary Lupien say, well, it's often, you know, sort of folklore and all these myths about what you're going to find when you work in the city, if you don't live there. So, I mean, I'm not sitting here saying, you know, that'll solve everything. Just make sure officers live in the city.
But
yeah, but I just don't know. So what are the things that would make an impact here in your mind, Melanie Funchess?
I mean, there's a number of things, right? What we need to rethink what community safety looks like and what are the people we need to have that happen and what are the roles that they need to play. We need transformational change. This is not about what do we need to do different with police. This is what is the new conversation that we need to have about what does safety look like for our community. And when you, because I was just listening to a program earlier today And one of the national activists was saying, close your eyes and think of the moment when you felt the most safe. And what did that look like? And I can guarantee you police were nowhere involved in it. Right? So let's back up, because when, you know, just like you said, when people think of the dirty, the bad city, it's just black people trying to live. We need to be not so heavily policed, and we need the same thing that is seen as not even thought about for other communities. We need to be respected. We need to have resources. We need to have all these things for people to understand that we are human. But the fact of the matter is, you got to see us and understand that we're living, breathing, bleeding human beings just like you, and we should be able to have the same things as you, so that we don't die.
Before I take some phone calls, Chaku, can you also weigh in on maybe as we try to be solutions oriented here, what is within reach of change? Some of what Melanie is talking about is really runs really deep, and it's going to take a long time, and that's important. Is there anything that's sort of in reach, whether it's enhancing PIC teams, following council's recommendation to send mental health advocates to all calls involving children, or otherwise, Chaku?
Yeah, I think there are. I mean, very concretely speaking, you know, there's a national 988 number that's being considered for implementation in a couple years that should be in play. However, we need an infrastructure in every state and every locality that actually is trusted and seen as a credible response for anybody to want to call 988 instead of 911, for example. And what that means are people who, and as Melanie pointed out, people who we can trust. And so a lot of times that includes not just mental health professionals as the alternative, but also those of us who identify as people with lived experience. A lot of times they're called peer specialists or recovery coaches, or there's a number of models that the CAHOOTS model also included. So I think we can build on the strategies of the PIC team, the style of de-escalation, I think we need to rethink some of the levels. I think our understanding of what safety is, Melanie was brilliant in the way she described that. I think it's very narrow right now in terms of what we perceive as dangerous. I shouldn't say it's narrow, it's broad. And we need to narrow that a little bit more so that we can actually see someone's big feelings as exactly that, and not immediately perceive dangerousness in those circumstances, and respond a little bit better by having the right people show up. And when police show up, or even when police are present, you know, it's those tools are the tools of force. So a voluntary, non-coercive model is what we need. And that's a lot of times what people are most worried about, even with the mental health professionals being engaged. They're so embedded in the police response model that they feel like it's just going to be another way, a pathway towards more force and coercion into the system, which is another problem. So I think the actionable next steps are to really expand the availability of the teams, increase the responsiveness and the involvement of the community, increase the capacity of the Police Accountability Board and the relationship between the board and the community and the police. I think these are major factors. And then, of course, transforming the department itself, because no training alone will accomplish this. The police department needs to be taking on that responsibility of rethinking safety in the way Melanie talked about, not just reacting to that conversation, really be in charge of it and let go of areas that are no longer needed.
After our only break, we're going to go ahead and take some listener emails and phone calls as we talk about the future of mental health response, community safety. You just heard Chaku Mathai, who is a mental health and substance use ex-patient and a recovery advocate from Rochester. He's also an appointed member of the New York State Behavioral Health Series Services Advisory Council and the vice president for the National Association for Rights Protection and Advocacy. Melanie Funches is a mental health advocate and a member of the Greater Rochester Black Agenda Group and the Black Healers Network. Mary Lupien is a member of Rochester City Council. And we're back with your feedback after this only break. Coming up in our second hour, we welcome a medical ethicist to talk about ethics during the pandemic. Is it right or wrong to stockpile vaccines in one country when so many countries around the world can't get their hands on vaccines? Is it right or wrong to close certain businesses but not others? To create a system where some can lock down but not others? We talk ethics during the pandemic next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let me get some phone calls and feedback. First, Jonathan in Lima. Go ahead, Jonathan.
Hey, Evan. I just wanted to take a second to just thank you. I appreciate what you do because you have guests on from the community who you don't just have a talk show. You have guests on from the community who are working to affect change, and it's amazing. I'm going to kind of pivot a little bit just to let your guests know. To thank Mayor Councilwoman Lupien for her share yesterday. On the topic of the young girl in Rochester, my wife and I got a chance to meet her. She's just a sweet little girl.
The 9-year-old girl.
The 9-year-old girl. We had an opportunity to just bring her a basket, just let her know that she's loved. We spoke just positivity over her. We let her know that she's loved, that her life has worth. And it was just an amazing experience that we got to be a part of. And immediately after I asked her, like, what do you want to be when you grow up? She said, I want to be a lawyer. So I asked her, I said, is it okay? You know, I asked her and her mother, is it okay that we set up a GoFundMe for you so we can get you some, you know, get you funding for college and everything? She said she liked the idea with that. So we organized with a trust lawyer. We set up a trust account. We have a GoFundMe, and it's all legit. I mean, the money can only be used for her future and well-being. It's illegal for anybody to use it in any other way. But all that to say, I just wanted to share with your guests and then our listeners in the Rochester area that if you just literally Google search help 9-year-old girl pepper sprayed, you'll be able to find, and you have to add GoFundMe, you'll be able to find where you can, we can't change what happened to her, but you'll be able to, you know, help towards her future. So I just wanted to thank you for that opportunity.
All right, Jonathan.
Thank you and your guests as well for everything you're doing.
Thank you for the phone call, Jonathan. I appreciate that. Obviously, I can't comment directly on individual fundraising goals, but I will say to Councilmember Lupien, that sounds like a legitimate, big-hearted effort. It's also, it kind of reminds me, I'm not telling people do or don't contribute. I mean, I'm sure people would probably like to help this girl. But it reminds me a little bit, Councilmember Lupien, of when people have medical bankruptcy and, you know, some news station will cover a GoFundMe as a heartwarming story when it's more indicative of how society just puts up all kinds of barriers and it requires a community effort to help people one by one instead of, you know, actually changing systems. But I don't know.
I agree with that. I think, you know, a lot of the situations that we see of, you know, not this one, but of violence in the community are because of a lack of resources. You know, the city, our system has divested in the city. It has divested in communities of color. And when there are many studies that show a direct correlation between, you know, neighborhoods with high unemployment rates and neighborhoods with high crime. And all across the country, we have seen spikes in violence due to COVID. And, you know, the underlying commonality is people are in economic and distress, and all of the supports that folks had have been ripped out from under them. And, you know, we really need to, if we want to live in a safe community, we really need to use our resources for the common good and make sure that people have what they need.
But I, that's not to disparage what Jonathan and his wife are trying to do here, and I know there is love and good intent there, and I appreciate the phone call, Jonathan. I'll also just say briefly, I mean, in regards to that case with the 9-year-old girl, just for listeners who emailed me last week who There was one listener who was surprised or was sort of condescending about the fact that I referenced having been a camp counselor myself. I wasn't saying that being a camp counselor is the same as being a police officer. What I was saying is anyone who has even just worked at a summer camp knows that if you handle a child in distress the way the police officers did with the 9-year-old girl who was eventually pepper sprayed, you have failed. Even a camp counselor who's 17 years old knows that. That's what I'm saying. Now, some people said, well, you don't know what the officers went through that day. And my response to that is, if you're a police officer who shows up on a scene like that and you cannot handle it, you need to let the department know. You need to say, I'm torched. I've been through trauma today in dealing with other calls. I can't do this appropriately. You're going to have to send somebody else. You've got to do that. You cannot show up and fail. And the community goes, well, you have a hard job. That cannot be the standard. That's what I'm saying. I have empathy for what officers deal with. I've said before, I wouldn't want to be a doctor or a police officer or a firefighter. Those are jobs that take a lot of work and focus, and I have respect for it. But you cannot show up and fail, and then people say, well, it's a hard job. You know, or maybe they went through something that day. That's not enough.
And
yeah.
Evan, I just want to say to what you just said,
yeah.
We don't say that they had a hard job when the people who are impacted, that we don't, that's not equal for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Let's be really real. And I agree with everything that you said. You know, we've got, since when, if you're supposed to protect and serve and I pay you, since when is it that my harm should be dismissed because you have a hard job if I'm paying you? So I just needed to put that out there, and I just wanted to say also that I want to make sure people heard what you said. I agree that the GoFundMes and things are incredible shows of the compassion of our community in cases like this. They are not just necessary for the fact that of what they generate, you know, like in terms of money, but the fact that it sends a very clear message to people who are hurting that there are other people who care about them.
Yeah,
but they should not be the substitute for a system to take care of its people.
Yeah, I think that's beautifully said. I appreciate that very much. Let me get back to the feedback from the community. This is Tim in Brighton. Go ahead, Tim.
Hi. I'm really finding the show interesting today, and I appreciate everyone's comments. I was just wondering if anyone on the panel has had a chance to listen to the tape that was released yesterday of the Gates Police Department's encounter with Tyshawn Jones the afternoon before he was shot in front of the Open Door Mission. Because I listened to that this morning, and I was just shocked. Because that's, in my mind, the way that so many of these encounters should have been handled or should be handled. The officer was respectful. He asked his name. The officer gave Tyshawn Jones his own name and emphasized the fact that he wasn't taking him to jail, but instead took him to a shelter. So I was just wondering if anyone on the panel had a reaction to that.
I appreciate that. Tim, Councilmember Lupien, you want to start there? You might be on mute, Mary. Go ahead.
Yeah, I had not actually heard that. It's surprising.
Okay. And I don't know if Chaku or Melanie want to weigh in. I don't know if you've seen the interaction that the caller is talking about. Chaku?
No, I haven't seen it yet, but I appreciate the point that those are certainly examples of the kind of empathy and response we'd want to see.
Yeah, it just strikes me, Chaku, that if an officer, first of all, if an officer doesn't give their own name or even tries to cover up the name on their uniform or refuses to give it when someone asks, that is a way of creating something intentionally adversarial. That's a way of saying, I'm not going to view you in human terms, and I don't want you to view me in human terms. You know, I am a police officer here to do work, and it involves something that is adversarial with you. And so what Tim is describing is an officer who said, hey, what's your name? Hey, my name is such and such, and I just want to talk to you. I know it sounds like nothing, but it is not nothing. I mean, Chaku, how do you feel about just the act of trying to humanize at the outset of an interaction?
Yeah, I think that's very much a first step in the process. It's something that is a standard protocol in a de-escalation process, is to establish a real rapport and alignment with the person that you're interacting with. And so police oftentimes are doing this, I find, with certain groups, but then not others. And so that's sometimes the distinction that I'm curious about, and oftentimes frustrated about, because I wonder when that gets dropped or how that gets dropped. I've seen some fantastic police interactions, including ones where I was involved with, where police were resources, recognized that their presence was agitating to people. So that needs a number of additional steps to exaggerate the other side of that experience. And in this sense, the human experience, as you were describing. Mm-hmm.
And Melanie Funchess, building on that point, can you just share some thoughts on how officers sometimes, I'm not trying to overgeneralize, but how we sometimes see officers respond to black girls differently?
All right. I want to say first that I did see the tape.
Oh, okay.
And I saw it, and the officer did everything right. You know, I give credit where credit is due, mm-hmm. right? When he came upon the gentleman, he didn't put his hand on him. He just talked to him and asked him about, you know, what's going on? Do you need help? You know, he said, my name is Mike. You can call me Mike. I mean, he literally took him to the shelter. The shelter would not admit him because he didn't have shoes. And it just so happens that the gentleman had seen the cop, had seen some shoes out on the grass. He went and got the grass and convinced the guy, even though they were these strange shoes, put on the shoes, because you put on the shoes, they'll let you in. The gentleman put on the shoes, he got inside. And he says, you know, I hope that things are going to go better for you now. You're going to get some help. I mean, up until the very last words that the officer said to this gentleman, it said, I am a resource. I see you. I hear you. And I'm here to help. That is how you do an interaction,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And so in terms of black girls, there are studies around black children generally and about black girls specifically about how black children are seen as older and larger than they actually are. Right. And that they are, and by virtue of this distortion, that they are treated, they are adultified, right? They are treated as if they are older and that they have capacities that they do not have because they are children. And for girls, this does not just happen in interactions with police. This happens in our schools. This happens in all kinds of interactions. And there's a book called Push Out that talks about this happening to black girls in our systems. And so this is an entire thing. And I just want to take one quick second to go back to say, when you asked me before, and I was angry, and I'm going to be honest, all my stuff, about what we can do differently. I believe that we can work with our community to come up with expanded resources like Chaku had, and like Chaku said, and also to lean into some things to keep our people from getting to the point of crisis. We keep talking about what do we do when the crisis happens. Well, how about we avert the crisis? And that is bolstering some of the systems and things that exist in our community and make sure people know what they are and have an education campaign for our community so people know what they are, know how to call them, know what they're for, and that they can get help before we get to the point of crisis. Mm-hmm.
Let me read just a quick email from Stefan in Rochester, who says, in addition to reimagining who responds to community crises, an important part of this discussion is accountability for those trusted with our public safety. It won't matter what training is received if officers are not held responsible when they misbehave, violate citizens' rights, or approach interactions with disproportionately aggressive responses. Could the city council address this issue? Can you, Mary Lupien, to Stefan's question, address that on counsel, or is this going to be settled in the courts with the Police Accountability Board and whether they get disciplinary power?
So whether the Police Accountability Board has disciplinary power, obviously that will make it the most able to hold individual officers accountable. In absence of that, and while we're waiting for the appeal to be decided, the Police Accountability Board has the ability to hold the department as a whole accountable, which is really powerful. And to be able to do that, they need to be fully funded to hire the staff that they need, because right now they only have one staff, and there's a graphic floating around out there that says, has 728 little men and one Police Accountability Board employee. To just show the difference of how we funded the Police Accountability Board versus the entire police department, and that that we have one employee to hold all of those people accountable. And we have a board that is working tirelessly for free to really dig in and, you know, do research into these recent incidents of police brutality, and to to get data and dig through it, and it's a lot of work. And so if we want police accountability, we have to make sure that we support it and fund it. They've had a lot of trouble getting answers from administration to their questions. There was a couple of council meetings earlier in the month where we went back and forth, the administration saying the Police Accountability Board already has what they need, and then finding out, no, actually they haven't gotten everything they need. And so it seems adversarial when it shouldn't have to be. I would think the goal of everyone is to make sure that justice is being served. So we have to fund them. We have to cooperate. And then the question of independence, making sure that they have access to independent legal counsel. We've seen on city council what happens when there's conflict of interest with a corporation counsel, with Tim Curtin, whose job is to really make sure that he's protecting and doing what the mayor asks him to do. And so council, we got our own independent counsel. It's right for the Police Accountability Board to do the same, because there may be instances when they have to investigate members of council, in terms of withholding information. So it's important that they have the independence and separation from counsel where it's appropriate to do what they need to do.
And Mary, before the hour is up, I just want to ask you briefly, Pastor Myra Brown wrote a public post about what she would have done differently if she were called to respond to the call that ended with Tyshawn's death. And let me just read a little bit of what she wrote, and I'd like to get your take here. She writes that, I would have acknowledged, if I were called to that, I would have acknowledged it was a mental health call and taken the dispatcher's words seriously to craft a real plan. I would call for backup from a black officer who actually understands how to connect culturally and at a humane level, and I would put them in charge of the orders on the ground. I would have initially, if he was going to get out of the car, attempted to establish a relationship of connection, which takes skill and training that the officer obviously did not have. I also would have gotten back into the car to craft a plan before those 100 or so steps were taken that ended up with 5 shots to his body. I would have called for the mental health crisis team while getting back in the car. I would have called for a black clergy on patrol that is always accessible to RPD, whom they use regularly on homicide calls. And I would have called for a pepper spray gun that RPD has regularly used on protesters inappropriately. Here was a chance to use it appropriately. End quote. Do you agree with Pastor Brown on that, Councilmember Lupien?
Absolutely. Reverend Myra has so much wisdom to share on this issue. She herself was trained in psychiatric care, and also, very tragically, Tyshawn Jones was also her cousin. So I'm sure she's feeling this extra deeply. There were so many things that could have been done differently, and she eloquently really lays them out of how this tragedy could have been avoided.
Well, in our last 40 seconds or so here, Melanie Funches, can you just leave listeners what you want them thinking about as we continue this community discourse about what happens next with mental health calls?
We as a community, it is our obligation as members of the Monroe County Greater Rochester community to look at one another and say, how do we keep us safe? And how do we do this in a way that fully sees the humanity of every individual? And that we make it so that people, when they call for help, that what they receive is actually help.
I'm going to state the obvious here. We need more time to talk about these issues, especially with the specifics of what is changing, what has been proposed, what it would look like, how it would work in practice. And we will do that. But in the meantime, I am grateful for the time of Melanie Funchess. Thank you for making time for the program, a member of the Greater Rochester Black Agenda Group and the Black Healers Network. Thank you, Melanie. Chaku Mathai, a mental health and substance use ex-patient and a recovery advocate from Rochester. He is vice president of the National Association for Rights Protection and Advocacy, among many other hats in this and other communities. Chaku, thank you for making time for us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Mary Lupien, a member of Rochester City Council. Mary, thank you.
Thank you.
Much more to come on that and more connections coming up in a moment.